from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The UN's chief nuclear watchdog, Mohamed El-Baradei, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, kicked off a three-day visit to Israel today with a nuclear-free Middle East on his mind. But with nuclear weapons technology more accessible than ever, and Iran appearing to be pushing toward its own nukes, that project would seem to be in trouble. And then there is Israel, a major nuclear power in its own right that won't even admit it has the weapons. El-Baradei spoke softly in Israel today, but the word from the IAEA in Vienna is that it's time for Israel to pull back the covers at least a bit, or even discuss disarmament to help cool an arms race. Israel says no way, not until it has peace agreements across the neighborhood. Tonight on Point, nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and the Israel factor. We begin in Tel Aviv, where Mohamed El-Baradei arrived today. Yossi Melman, a staff writer for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, is covering the visit. I asked him to describe what El-Baradei and Israel are talking about.
Just for the sake of talking, actually, there is very little in common between Israel's nuclear policy and IAEA, the agency which Mr. Baradei represents.
Mr. Baradei wants a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, and the sounds coming out of Vienna and the IAEA are that part of that might be for Israel to stand up and declare its own nuclear weapons program. Is there any chance whatsoever of Israel doing that?
No, not at the moment. Just before the visit, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon released a statement making it absolutely clear that Israel does not have any intentions of changing its policy, the policy of ambiguity, which means basically we neither deny nor confirm that we do have nuclear weapons.
Remind us why Israel maintains this policy, the policy of nuclear ambiguity.
It's a very clever policy. Israel was the first nation to produce nuclear weapons after the five superpowers, the U.S., the Soviet Union, China, France, and the U.K. And Israel did not want to provoke the world, especially not the United States and not the Arab world. By acknowledging that it does have nuclear weapons, it would have probably provoked the world. And therefore, the Israeli policy was and still is, we are not going to be the first nation to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. It doesn't mean that we don't have them. We will not introduce them. And I think this policy, which is already in existence since 43 years ago, originally it was kind of a comment made, maybe a very instinctive comment made by Deputy Defense Minister Shimon Peres in 61 when he met with President Kennedy. This policy is still in existence, and it has proved its merit.
Israel is now reported to have several hundred nuclear weapons. As an Israeli reporter, are you free to report that, to comment on that?
We are not free to investigate that. We are free to comment and report if the stories are coming outside Israel, what we call in this country foreign reports. But obviously, if I go and search and investigate what's going on in the nuclear reactor in Dimona, which supposedly is producing plutonium for nuclear weapons, I won't be allowed to publish the story, and maybe I would be charged with revealing state secrets.
Dimona there in the Negev Desert. Now, meanwhile, IAEA chief Mohamed El-Baradei arrives, and he arrives at a time when Iran is apparently, despite its protestations, apparently continuing an effort to develop nuclear weapons itself. How does the Israel visit fit into the effort to maintain nonproliferation in Iran?
That's Mr. Baradei's main argument. He says, when I go to Tehran and press them not to produce nuclear weapons, they come back to me and ask, why you pick on us and what about the Israelis? So his main argument is that Israel is a source of instability in the region because it provokes the Arab world. It gives incentives to states in the region, including Iran, to try to counter Israel's nuclear supremacy by producing their own weapons of mass destruction.
So, Yossi Melman, then, what is the interpretation in Israel of why Mohamed El-Bardeh has come. If Israel's not going to change his policy, what's the point of the visit?
It's not that simple. Israel is a member of the IAEA. Israel does have very cordial and sometimes cooperative relations with the agency. Israel has a small nuclear research reactor given by the United States in 1960 in its Atom for Peace plan. And this installation is frequently visited and inspected by IAEA inspectors. Israel is participating in IAEA plan to prevent nuclear material to fall into the hands of terrorists. So Israel is a prominent and very active member on various IAEA and UN forums, and therefore his visit is very natural. It is a rare visit in the sense that it's the first time it is publicized. He visited Israel 6 years ago, but there was no word about it in the media.
But there was nothing like the same tension in the air 6 years ago. Now, Iran appears to be moving toward developing nuclear weapons. Is Mr. El-Bardeh trying at least to be able to say to Tehran, well, I've gone to Israel, I'm talking to them, I'm trying?
Well, exactly. It gives him another excuse, if you want, or justification. But the tension in the region has nothing to do with Israel's nuclear weapons. Israel has never threatened to use them. Israel is not spreading nuclear material. Although Israel has never signed the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Israel is not spreading nuclear material. Israel is not cooperating with other nations in the field of nuclear weapons. And he needs Israel. If he wants to start the talks about creation of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, and in order to achieve that goal, just the beginning of talks, not to conclude them, he needs Israel to be part of that dialogue. And I have to also mention that Israel did not say, we are not ready to start a negotiation or a dialogue. Israel is ready to begin the dialogue. The question is whether the issue of nuclear weapons would be first on the agenda, as the Arab countries demand, or the last one, after Israel would have disagreements and security arrangements with its neighbors.
Yossi Melman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yossi Melman is a staff writer for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He spoke with me from Tel Aviv. We're talking tonight about nuclear proliferation and the Israel factor. Can the world ask all the Middle East to stay non-nuclear while Israel is fully armed? Can the world ask Israel to drop its weapons when it doesn't have peace with its neighbors? Is it time for Israel to drop its ambiguity and at least have a frank discussion about its nuclear arsenal, or time to stay the quiet course? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Bethesda, Maryland, is Ambassador Thomas Graham Jr., former Special Representative for Arms Control under President Clinton, and co-author of an article in the May-June issue of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, arguing that Israel should be pulled into the world's non-proliferation framework. Good evening and welcome, Ambassador Graham.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Also joining us tonight from Tacoma Park, Maryland, is Joseph Cirincione, Director of the Nonproliferation Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Cirincione.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us. First to you, Ambassador Graham. You've written recently or co-authored a piece in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists saying that Israel's position of nuclear ambiguity is not only anachronistic, it is now counterproductive. Could you give us a quick history lesson in when and how Israel came to have nuclear weapons and how it developed this original position of ambiguity about whether or not it even had them, its don't ask, don't tell position?
Well, very briefly, Israel began building a nuclear weapon program in the late 50s through the 60s, and by 1967 had one or two workable devices, still a rather preliminary program, but they had crossed the threshold at that point. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, entered into force in 1970, and it became a centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. But here, on the one hand, the U.S. is campaigning for nonproliferation around the world. On the other hand, one of its closest allies has just crossed the threshold. Israel believed that it had to have nuclear weapons for its own security. That's why it built them in the first place. But it understood that this could be embarrassing for the United States. So Prime Minister Golda Meir and President Nixon agreed on this don't ask, don't tell policy that Israel would maintain the bomb in the basement, would not try to use it either militarily or politically in any way, wouldn't say much about it, and the U.S. would go on campaigning for nonproliferation around the world. That policy made a lot of sense in 1969. It doesn't make any sense today because everyone knows that Israel has nuclear weapons, but yet nobody can talk about it. And nothing can be done to try to make the situation better and more politically stable as a result.
Joseph Cerenzioni, bring us up to date then, if you would. What does Israel's nuclear arsenal look like today? How much is known, and how does it figure in to the conversation that Mohammed El-Baradei is attempting to lead across the Middle East?
Well, all estimates of Israel's nuclear arsenal are based on estimates of how much plutonium it's been able to produce at its nuclear reactor in Dimona, as you said, in the Negev Desert. The estimates are that there's enough plutonium for between 90 and 200 nuclear weapons, although most experts, and I'm among them, believe that Israel most likely has the lower end of that spectrum, so about 100 nuclear weapons actually constructed. It has delivery vehicles of three kinds, aircraft, including F-16s and F-15s that can drop air-dropped bombs. It has short-range ballistic missiles, including the Jericho 1 and the Jericho 2, that can hit almost all the countries in the Middle East. And it has recently added three German-made submarines, which we believe have cruise missiles that have been modified to be able to carry nuclear warheads on them. So it has a U.S.-style triad that can deliver nuclear weapons pretty much anywhere it wants to.
So those are some pretty arresting facts. How do those factor into the conversation when Mohammed El-Baradei goes to Tehran and says to them, as he hasn't been very successful so far in doing, but at least tries to encourage them not to push any further down the road toward nuclear armaments?
Well, Mohammed El-Baradei works for the Board of Governors of the IAEA, 35-nation board, and they have repeatedly over the past few years urged the entire body, including the Director General, to work towards a weapons-free Middle East, a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. That actually is official U.S. policy. Israel agrees with this policy. And after the first Gulf War in 1991, then President Bush, and then Soviet Union President Mikhail Gorbachev convened a Middle East peace conference that was trying to work towards this effort. Didn't succeed for several reasons, but the policy remains on the books. And here's El-Baradei trying to revive this. He understands two things. One, that he is never going to succeed in convincing Iran or other Arab or Muslim states to permanently give up their nuclear ambitions unless Israel is involved in the equation. And that, two, this is a long race. This is a long battle to get a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. Just because he's going there today and President Sharon of Israel rejects the idea doesn't mean that he can't be in there pitching, trying to get the idea, trying to work the idea. This is a long campaign. This is just one stop on that campaign.
Maybe a long campaign, but Iran seems to have ambitions that are clear and relatively present. Joseph Cerenzioni, Ambassador Thomas Graham, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and the Israel factor. Is it time for Israel to drop the ambiguity about its nuclear weapons and at least have a frank conversation? Or if Iraq is quietly going nuclear or attempting to, can Israel afford to back down an inch? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and the Israel factor. You can join the conversation. Is Israel a special case? Can any country ultimately be exempt from the non-proliferation effort? And with unending conflict and mobile technology, can the Middle East be saved from nuclear anarchy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Bethesda, Maryland, by Ambassador Thomas Graham, former special representative for arms control under President Clinton. He was co-author with Avner Cohen of an article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, May-June issue, a nuclear non-proliferation treaty for non-members. They're focused on Israel, Pakistan, and India. Also from Tacoma Park, Maryland tonight, Joseph Cerencioni, Director of Nonproliferation Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Deadly Arsenals. We're joined right now by caller Charles from Montreal in Canada. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Well, thanks.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, like if we had the doctrine for a long time during the Cold War of mutual destruction between...
they attacked us, we would attack them, everybody would go down.
Why isn't that doctrine also good for the Middle East? And also, how can we really look at the rest of the Middle East? I'm always amazed that we can tell the rest of the Middle East, Iran in particular, who has never really attacked, from what I know, has never invaded anybody's country, invaded anyone, how we can tell them that they cannot have nuclear weapons, Israel can have nuclear weapons, and we can basically say your societies can grow and be as strong as you want. Mm. But you cannot be militarily as strong as Israel. But you can economically can go strong.
Charles, let me ask you, would you feel better? Would you feel safer? Would the world be a better place if more countries have nuclear weapons, whatever countries those may be?
I obviously would feel better if more countries would have less. But I don't feel necessarily good that one country has a dominance over another country.
Let us pick it up, Charles, and thanks for calling. Thomas Graham, how about it? Put this in context. Give us a little tutorial in the non-proliferation movement. Charles says, look, fair is fair. If Israel and other nations have nuclear weapons, why should anyone be denied?
Well, of course, he's put his finger on one of the central issues. In 1968-1970, it was agreed that we would stop the spread of nuclear weapons where it then was, five states, U.S., U.K., France, Soviet Union, and China, and then try to prevent nuclear weapons from spreading anywhere else. Already, Israel had a program, India had a program, and Pakistan later developed one. It's difficult to argue that no other country should have nuclear weapons when three countries are outside the treaty and do have nuclear weapons. But it's imperative that we do so, because if nuclear weapons do spread to additional countries, and I think Iran is a very important case here, North Korea is another one, then that could gradually gain momentum and more countries would develop nuclear weapons until the predictions that were around in the early 60s in the Kennedy administration become a fact. That is, that there could be 25 or 30 or more countries with nuclear weapons.
So-called nuclear anarchy.
Well, if that were to happen, it would virtually assure that every confrontation or conflict would carry with it the risk of going nuclear, and it would be virtually impossible to keep these weapons out of the hands of terrorists, because they'd be so widespread.
So you've written in Bulletin of Atomic Scientists that you said the world is coming to a historically decisive moment in its effort to promote nuclear nonproliferation. And you've attached to that a plea or some advice for Israel, Pakistan, India. What are you suggesting here about Israel's position of nuclear ambiguity and the others?
Well, I think some settlement has to be reached reasonably soon. Here we have three full-blown nuclear weapon programs outside of the treaty while trying to hold everyone else in the treaty.
And Pakistan and India making no bones about theirs. They're very upfront.
India and Pakistan, yes. And then we have North Korea, of course, recently having left the treaty.
So what are you saying Israel should do, focusing on the Middle East here?
We just made a suggestion in the article, but I believe it is important to be able to discuss the Israeli program, just like we can discuss the Indian and Pakistani programs.
Why? Why is the ambiguity now anachronistic, counterproductive, as you say?
Because how can you come to any kind of resolution, like I argue we need to do, unless you can talk about it? Right now, these programs are completely unrestrained. There's no limit on them whatsoever, and they exist outside the NPT.
Pakistan's and India's as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that for much longer the non-proliferation treaty can hold together effectively unless at least something is being done about these programs. I'm not saying the three countries should join the NPT as non-nuclear weapon states. That's clearly impossible.
That is, give up their nuclear weapons.
Give up their nuclear weapons. And the other parties to the treaty are not going to change it to permit them to join as nuclear weapon states. So whatever resolution is reached, it has to be something other than those two outcomes. And so it is suggested in the article that some kind of agreement among the three restraining their programs and linking that to the non-proliferation treaty regime be developed. So there would at least be some initial limitations on these programs.
Ambassador Graham, thanks for joining us tonight. I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for your piece and for being with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
Ambassador Thomas Graham, former Special Representative for Arms Control under President Clinton. Abraham is calling from Queens in New York. Hi, Abraham. You're on the air.
Hi. I was listening to the conversation. I think there's an element here that's being ignored totally. And Israel is being treated like Pakistan, India, like another country in the Middle East. But the situation is unique, and I think your guests have ignored that Israel is the smallest country in the Middle East. It's a country that's been threatened, the only country in the world that I know of that's been threatened by annihilation by its neighbors. Iran has publicly sworn to destroy Israel, annihilate it, and this has been coming out of Syria as well, and Libya, and other countries in the Middle East. And I think a small country of 6 million people surrounded by almost a billion people, its neighbors, would be irresponsible to disarm its nuclear weapon. It's the only card it really has against being attacked by a massive attack as happened in 73 and 67. Israel's fear is being attacked by its neighbors at once and possibly some kind of a plot to annihilate it in an attack by neighbors.
Saying, Abraham, come on, this is a special case. Let's recognize that and offer some understanding here.
Right, and I think it will be impossible until peace is achieved in the Middle East for Israel even to contemplate disarming, because it would be bringing upon its destruction or inviting possibly a new war. I mean, it would tempt its enemies to consider a sneak attack or massive attack of annihilation. So being a country that's threatened with annihilation and its neighbors openly threatening them, the only thing it can do is have this card and just say, we have nuclear weapons, or hinted having nuclear weapons. So
right.
Israel's pressure this time is unrealistic.
We've got it. Abraham, thanks so much for your call. Let me pick it up with Joseph Srincioni. Joseph, what do you think? Anyone can understand that argument. Small country, a lot of unfriendly neighbors. They need to have an ace in the hole. And yet we hear Ambassador Thomas Graham saying something has to be done, or else this is pushing into more proliferation, which ultimately, I guess the extension is, may not be so good for Israel either. How do you read the current situation in Israel's interests, the region's interests, global interest here?
Yeah, well, your caller makes several excellent points, and let me give full disclosure here. I have family in Israel. My mother and father-in-law live in Netanya. My sister-in-law and her family live in Jerusalem. So I'm very sensitive to the security situation in Israel, and I understand both the caller's analysis and the feeling of people in Israel that they are under attack. The caller's absolutely right. There are some countries that do not recognize Israel's right to exist. They have been threatened by leaders of some of these countries with total annihilation.
And Israel does say or indicate that it would talk about disarmament on the other side of peace treaties, as I understand.
Well, Israel right now would be crazy to unilaterally disarm, but nobody's talking about that. See, you can understand why Israel acquired this arsenal in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, but right now Israel has conventional military superiority in the region. There is no nation or combination of nations that can defeat Israel conventionally. So Israel's security interests are in making sure that no country in that region acquires the one weapon that could threaten Israel, a nuclear bomb. And here's the problem for Israel. The status quo is unstable. It's not a choice between keeping things the way they are and doing something else. You cannot keep things the way they are permanently. They have a choice between a world, in a Middle East, where no one has nuclear weapons, or a Middle East where there are four or five nuclear powers.
And, in fact, that's beginning to happen right now with Iran.
If Iran goes nuclear, they will not be alone. They will be joined quickly by Egypt, who used to have a nuclear weapons program, Saudi Arabia, which can't allow Iran to become the dominant power in the region, and perhaps even smaller countries such as Syria. There are already rumors of some Syrian interest in this. So that's a situation. That would be an extremely dangerous and unstable situation. And as Ambassador Graham said, not just the state threat, but the possibility of a terrorist group, or that a country would acquire a nuclear weapon, or that one of these countries would convulse in an internal rebellion and some faction would gain control of a nuclear weapon.
So what does that suggest to you in terms of policy for Israel? How should Israel respond to this dilemma then?
The recommendation, and Tom Graham and I differ a little on the tactical path, but the basic thrust is the same, is that Israel has to join the game. Basically, it has to take its bombs out of the basement and put them on the table and start negotiating an arrangement where they can verifiably end the other guy's nuclear programs while they move step by step towards reducing their arsenal and eventually eliminating it. And the caller is absolutely right. This can only be done in the context of a regional peace settlement where countries recognize Israel's right to exist, where there are confidence-building measures built up, and a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That sounds complicated and hard, and it is, but it's a lot easier than a Middle East with four or five nuclear powers.
Justice Cerencioni, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington Patrick Clausen. He's deputy director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's formerly a senior research professor at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Good evening and welcome, Patrick Clausen.
Glad to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. You hear Joe Cerencioni saying there's too much danger in Israel sustaining its current policy of ambiguity. It's time to join the game, to pull the bombs out of the basement, to put them on the table and say, let's talk about this. What do you think?
Well, I think Joe Cerencioni makes a very good point that the Middle East could be on the brink of seeing a proliferation of nuclear weapon states and that we need to do something in order to stop that. Where I would differ with him very much is, would it help stop proliferation if Israel openly acknowledged that it had a nuclear weapon? And I'm afraid that, Joe, that if Israel openly acknowledges that it has a nuclear weapon, that'll be like poking its finger in the eye of sensitive Arab sentiment. And it really helps a lot if we can keep that bomb in the basement and we can come up with measures that'll help build confidence and build stability in the region that will help move us towards a goal of limiting the risks of proliferation. For instance, Israel has signed a treaty that was negotiated, which is called the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, mm-hmm. in which Israel promised it wouldn't make any more bomb material for nuclear weapons. And it's those kinds of confidence and stability-building measures which I think would be the best way to get to the common goal that all of us share of how to stop proliferation in the area and move towards that nuclear-free Middle East that we all want.
But Patrick Clausen, let me ask you then, isn't it, in fact, right now moving the other way? All the noises out of the IAEA, Europe, Washington are very distressed about what's up in Iran, despite some denials there. Joe Cerencioni says, look, it's happening. Iran may be moving toward this, and as soon as it gets it, or shortly thereafter, you're going to see it also in a handful of other Middle Eastern countries. Does Israel have the luxury of waiting? How do you respond to the fact of apparent imminent or coming proliferation?
Well, I'm suggesting that if Israel were to go public with its nuclear weapons, that would make the problem in the area worse.
But isn't it already there? Isn't it already happening?
it's a bad problem in the area. Let's not make it into a worse problem in the area. In other words, if Iran does move towards nuclear weapons much further, then we in the United States and we in the West, including Europe, need to come up with a variety of measures which will help reinforce the deterrence against Iran and provide greater confidence to Israel so that Israel can keep its bomb in the basement and move towards some arms control measures like agreeing not to make any more new weapons.
Got it.
And that's going to be it's going to be a dance that we and the Europeans have to do to stop further proliferation in the area.
David is calling from Hoboken, New Jersey. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm an American who just recently returned from Iran, and frankly, it opened my eyes visiting there. And on the nuclear issue especially, the Iranians I ran into who didn't want the bomb nevertheless insisted that the nonproliferation treaty itself gives them the right to the full nuclear cycle. And they say that regardless, they're entitled to that according to the nonproliferation treaty itself. And the other ones wanted the bomb, and not just because of Israel's potential threat to Iran, but because there are other powers in the region, conventional powers, which Iran needs a deterrent against.
Such as?
The United States, for one thing. We've gone around threatening them right and left. If we were in Iran's position, wouldn't we consider a deterrent force?
Axis of evil. David, we have just a few seconds before the break. Let me turn to Joe Srincioni with that, and thanks for your call. Joe, is there any reading of the Nonproliferation Treaty that would give Iran an opening to legitimately have nuclear weapons?
This is Iran's position, not nuclear weapons, but the capability to make the material that could go into nuclear weapons, because the same process that they say they want to build to construct fuel rods to go into reactors can be used to make highly enriched uranium, the stuff that goes inside a nuclear weapon. That's what the debate's all about with Iran right now. Can you let them have that capability, and can you believe their alleged peaceful purposes for their program?
And what about David's point that it's not just Israel that Iran may want a nuclear device for defense against? What about the United States next door and any number of other potential threats?
Well, that's absolutely right. Israel is not the primary motivating factor. I don't think the United States was until very recently. The program for Iran began under the Shah, when the U.S. sold the Shah of Iran its first nuclear reactor. When the Ayatollah came in 1979, he shut the program down. He thought it was Western technology that would increase Iran's dependence on the West. They restarted it in the mid-80s during the war with Iraq. It was Iraq that was seen as a threat. That was a motivating factor for Iran restarting its nuclear program.
And now here it comes, and Mohammed El-Bardeh, who's in Israel tonight, hears from Iran. If Israel has the bomb, why not us? We're talking about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and the Israel factor. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East and the Israel factor. You can join the conversation. Is it time for Israel to drop the ambiguity about its nuclear weapons and at least have a frank conversation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Patrick Clausen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and from Tacoma Park, Maryland, by Joseph Srincioni, Director of Nonproliferation Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Joe Srincioni, I want to raise Patrick Clausen's challenge to you and surface it again. He said, look, if there's a problem here, Patrick, forgive me if I get it wrong, or correct me if I get it wrong, but don't look to Israel to bring the bombs out of the basement. Rather, let's impose a framework that will restrain and incent Iran against developing nuclear weapons. What do you say, Joe?
Well, you have to do both. And this is the problem Mohammed El-Bardeh is wrestling with. And this is one of the reasons he's going to Israel, to show in part to Iran and other Muslim and Arab nations that he has an even-handed approach to this. He doesn't have a double standard. The problem he's got is that you have to crack down at Iran. Unlike Israel, Iran appears to be violating its treaty obligations. See, Israel, in developing its nuclear program, did not violate the NPT.
Because there was no NPT, and it hadn't signed, well, didn't ever sign on to the nonproliferation when there was.
Right, they never signed it. So they opted out of that system. Iran opted into the system in order to acquire the nuclear technology.
That is for nuclear energy production.
And everyone, I mean, I'm sure Patrick and I would agree that Iran's civilian nuclear program is, in great part, a cover for to acquiring the technologies they could use to build nuclear weapons. So you have to crack down on Iran. And one of the ways al-Baradei wants to do this is to say you cannot acquire that technology for enriching uranium for fuel rods. We can no longer allow states to acquire that technology. I agree with that position, but you can't make that position only on Iran. You're going to have to apply it to other countries as well. It has to be a universal standard. Everyone has to comply with it. Well, that brings you almost immediately over to Israel, who, of course, is in a similar situation. Does Israel have the right to acquire that technology or not? And that's why you have to deal with both of these problems at once. In many ways, dealing with the proliferation problem is like playing three-dimensional chess. You have to be operating and moving several pieces at the same time.
But to Patrick Claussen's point, if Israel does bring the bombs out of the basement and say, hey, yes, we have 100 or 200, or I've even read 300 nuclear weapons, why is that not a stick in the eye of the broader Middle East community, a prod to more rapid development of nuclear weapons of their own?
Patrick is the Middle East expert here, and especially on the Iranian question. I greatly respect his expertise, and he has a point, and this is an argument that comes up in this debate. Don't make it so obvious. Don't force Egypt, for example, to react to this. The problem is, I think, that everyone knows that Israel has these weapons. It's no secret on the Arab street or in the Arab capitals, and there is so much animosity towards the United States right now, such distrust towards the West, that we have to go the extra mile. We have to take dramatic steps before this sentiment in the Muslim and Arab world hardens into a permanent hostility, and this terrorist movement, this terrorist ideology, gains even more adherence. Part of that, just a part of it, but an important part of it, is showing that we're even-handed in our applications and that the rules that we're insisting Iran live by are rules that we're also willing to apply to Israel and to ourselves, that we have to take steps to reduce our nuclear arsenals as well, to devalue nuclear weapons and not to make them an integral part of our security strategy.
Patrick Claussen, how about it? No reason not to put them on the table, not to bring them out of the basement. It's an open secret. Everyone knows Israel has them. And if there's not more radical movement, then
a lot of open secrets that everybody finds more convenient to keep hidden. We like to keep those skeletons in the closet because if we bring them out into the middle of the living room and we have to stare at them all the time, it doesn't help things.
And then the further point Joe Cirincione makes is, well, if you leave this open secret festering, you just cement conflict between Israel and the broader region, between the United States and the broader region.
Well, that's why you want to take confidence and stability-building measures. And there are a variety of things that you can do. For instance, Israel's reactor, from which it's developed its nuclear material for its bombs, is very old. And Israel probably will have to shut that reactor down pretty soon. Well, why don't we encourage the Israelis to shut down that reactor at Dimona? That would be a much more practical step, and one that I think would be better appreciated in the region. That reactor at Dimona is at least as well known as Israel's nuclear programs. Let's say Israel's going to shut down its reactor and then won't be able to produce more nuclear material.
So don't bring them out of the basement, but take a step that would mean no more production. Interesting option. Michael's calling from New York. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm not Jewish. I'm an American, and I don't believe that Israel should either disclose that she has nuclear weapons or, in fact, put them on the negotiation table.
What's your reasoning, Michael?
My reasoning is that even if Israel does put them on the table, there's nothing that any of the other countries can put on the table to counter that. And there's no reason to believe that there would be the kind of disclosure that's necessary. Second of all, I think that Israel's possession of nuclear weapons provides a sort of for Arab and Middle Eastern countries, whether they admit it or not, because each of the Middle Eastern countries also fear aggression from other Israeli Middle Eastern countries. Thirdly, I think that if Israel would not give them up because they cannot rely on America to defend them in the event of an emergency, and we as Americans should realize that the second we ask Israel to give up those weapons, we have to be committed to step in and commit troops to defend Israel's independence. That having said, I think it serves no one for them to be disclosed or to ask Israel to give up the weapons.
Michael, we've got it. Thanks so much for your call. Joe Cirincione, what do you say?
Well, many of the security threats that Israel faces are not defendable with nuclear weapons. I mean, Israel's main security problem right now is not from a state attack on Israel. It's from the internal Palestinian conflict. Nuclear weapons are useless against that. It faces terrorist attacks. Nuclear weapons are useless against that. Israel, in some ways, has never been more secure, has never had a greater defense conventionally against the kind of state attacks that it has experienced in the past. Syria is not going to attack it. Iran is not going to attack it. Egypt is not going to attack it. Iraq has just been eliminated as a threat. Libya has just abandoned its nuclear weapons program. Now is the time to seize the momentum, and I think this is part of al-Baradei's reasoning. He understands that the strategic dynamic has been shaken up in the Middle East, and we don't want that to settle down in an unfavorable pattern. He's trying to get in there and play to develop that in a positive direction. Look at Israel's position. Two of its key adversaries, Iraq and Libya, have just been eliminated from the weapon of mass destruction game, albeit by different methods, but that is a tangible improvement. And Iran's program has been uncovered and is now subject to very rigorous inspections, although the Iran situation is unstable and could flip either way. Now's the time to seize that momentum, to create a new dynamic, see if you can't push it in a direction where everybody is reducing their nuclear programs and their other chemical and possibly biological programs.
So bombs out of the basement. Patrick Claussen, what about it? We've just got half a minute. Is there a momentum here, as Joe Cerencioni describes, that Israel might help along by some greater degree of candor, or you say no way, no how, keep them locked down?
Keep them locked down, and the momentum that we need to create is to get the Chemical Weapons Convention signed by Middle Eastern states, which are so far refusing to do it, such as the Syrians, who are building hundreds of missiles topped with some of the most advanced chemical weapons in the world aimed at Israel.
But are they doing that because they don't have nukes and Israel does?
Correct.
Is it related?
And what we ought to do is go for a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, which is what the Egyptians have proposed, the Israelis have endorsed. A big step in that direction would be getting the Syrians to agree to sign on to the Chemical Weapons Convention. Let's say that if Israel is going to make some progress about shutting down some of its nuclear production activities, let's get the Syrians to sign on to the Chemical Weapons Convention. Let's get momentum on chemical weapons as well as on nuclear weapons.
Well, it sounds as though this conversation itself may be a part of some more daylight here. We'll see where it goes. Patrick Claussen, great to have you, and thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Patrick Claussen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Joseph Cerencioni, Director of Nonproliferation Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Wonderful having you on. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Shalom.
Shalom. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. In a moment, lamenting the carb counting craze, this is On Point. Low-carb diet craze seems to be everywhere these days. Subway has its Atkins roll-up. Coca-Cola has just unveiled C2, which contains half the carbohydrates of the original. And Auntie Anne's has apparently figured out a way to create a carb-conscious pretzel. California writer Kathleen Clary Miller isn't buying into the carb-counting trend. In this radio diary, she wonders if Americans are becoming less happy by denying themselves the joy of sweets and fresh-baked bread.
While lunching at a small local bistro with my daughter, I asked the waitress if the restaurant had any bread to accompany an exotic variety of greenery piled high on our plates. Bread? Do you really want it? Her incredulous expression, combined with her youth, caused me to wonder if her generation had perhaps been brainwashed to believe that what used to be known as the staff of life is, in fact, poisonous. When a few moments later, four tiny slices of finger-width toast were placed before us, enough carbohydrates for one day's point count, the chef must have informed her, I despaired and realized that what I'd read in the paper must be true. More people than ever are heading for the doctor on a quest for antidepressants. And many of these, not so coincidentally, are the same tortured souls who have eliminated fat and carbohydrates from their diets. sans salty serotonin, who wouldn't be miserable, unable to determine the meaning of life? In 4 crouton bites, we consumed our table allotment of wicked white flour, as I recited to my daughter the memories I cherished from a kitchen childhood. She couldn't imagine that we had come home from school each afternoon to Swedish butter cookies, still slippery warm on the baking sheet, and she scoffed at our teenage idea of cutting back on calories to only a brick of Monterey Jack and just a box of full-fat crackers. And on Sundays, the religious experience of breakfast at Pasadena's Huntington Hotel was the spiritual incentive to get out of bed and accompany my mother to church. The bacon was extra crispy, the softened butter so sweet. Then there was dinner at my grandmother's house. Mun's mantra was butter, gravy, sugar, and cream. We would gather around the dining room table, salivating, impatient for grace to be said so we could eat. In the summer, Mun's idea of our seaside vacation dessert was to cut a chocolate cake into 4 wedges. My sister, my 2 cousins, and I would each grab a slab, devouring it as we walked around Balboa Island in Newport Beach, barefoot and not a carbo care in the world. We were quicker to smile then, prone to laugh in the face of potential catastrophe. And although I have always chalked up such natural ease to the unadulterated innocence of youth, I now wonder if my devil's food diet had something to do with it. Yes, I know it's not heart healthy. I, too, have been known to raise my glass, red wine only, on hearing after the annual physical that my LDL and HDL cholesterol levels have crossed the finish line in the correct ratio. But I also get a supernatural high as my husband and I head toward the hot dogs, salted peanuts, and beer at a baseball game. Now, I have to confess, I have been a champion of omega-3 and bit hook, line, and sinker into the idea of soy supremacy. Between classes at the high school where I taught for a time, I threw down handfuls of the stuff before each bell rang, until one fateful Friday when the In-N-Out Burger catering truck pulled into the parking lot. In a moment of temporary insanity, I wolfed down a double-double cheese with fries and decided right then and there that if I ate even one more soy nut, longer life or not, I would commit suicide. Can I ever find a way to look forward to a salad with no dressing at a table with no bread? It may be better for my body, but it is certain sorrow to my soul. Life is not about quantity, it's all about quality and soul, which sadly, we seem to be confusing with prescriptions. So please pass me the poppy seed Prozac. By next week, recipe research will no doubt uncover the savory solution for our inability to cope with the madness. Bread and butter has been, all along, the manna that fed us all in the wilderness.
Kathleen Clary Miller lives in San Juan Capistrano, California. Her first novel is The Man in My Mailbox. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.